This is the Takeaway Podcast. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. Are we seeing the pendulum swinging at the United Nations in favor of international consensus and even caution regarding the crisis in Syria? There's a surprising question. Later this hour, we're going to talk about how your face is destiny. Helen of Troy launched 1,000 ships. How would you like your face to launch 1,000 gigs of personal data? We're going to have a closer examination of where the law stands on government use of facial recognition technology. Also, is a mosque an appropriate place to snoop for terrorists? The NYPD says yes. But first,
if in fact we make a choice to have repercussions for the use of chemical weapons, then the Assad regime, which is involved in a civil war, trying to protect itself, will have received a pretty strong signal that, in fact, it better not do it again.
President Obama speaking on the PBS NewsHour program yesterday. You know, it was one of those wild bits of historical intersection irony. I don't know what you would call it. On the front page of the New York Times 50 years ago, right next to the story about the March on Washington and Dr. Martin Luther King's speech, there was a story of a crisis in Syria 50 years ago. The United States was asking the UN to intervene back then in a bloody border dispute between Syria and Israel in the aftermath of a coup in Damascus back in 1963. Well, 50 years later, the U.S. and an American president speaking about getting the United Nations authorization for military action in Syria, and the UN is pushing back. There have been calls for delay from UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon while inspectors in Syria try to assess details of what the U.S. and others insist was a chemical weapons attack last week in the Damascus suburbs, but impatience from the international community.
We believe that it's time the United Nations Security Council shouldered its responsibilities on Syria, which for the last 2.5 years it has failed to do.
That's British Foreign Secretary William Hague echoing Prime Minister David Cameron. But after moving aggressively to petition the UN for military authorization, the British government is now getting pushback from its own opposition in London. Meanwhile, accusations to cloud the issue from Syria itself. Syria's ambassador to the United Nations, Bashar Jafari, has reported evidence of 3 previously undocumented instances of chemical weapons use, claiming rebels used poison gas on August 22nd, 24th, and 25th, also in the Damascus suburbs. The United States could move without a UN mandate, but will it? Russia's argument that U.S. credibility about weapons of mass destruction is dubious today because of what happened after the 2003 invasion of Iraq. And the U.N. is in the middle of a crisis in Syria once again. Joining us now is Ambassador Christopher Hill, former U.S. ambassador to Iraq, assistant secretary of state, and an envoy to negotiations over Kosovo and North Korea. He's currently dean of the Korbel School of International Studies at the University of Denver. Ambassador, welcome.
Thank you very much.
It seems, thinking back to 2003, thinking of all of the various interactions between the United States, NATO, and the United Nations, this particular crisis is showing the UN to be remarkably resilient and at least pushing for some delay here, even though there's lots and lots of precedent for just working around the United Nations. What's going on here?
Well, I think what we've had is a civil war that has gone on for some 2 years. We have a regime that not only never signed the chemical weapons ban, but also have been moving chemical weapons storage around and have various chemical weapons units. And so we've come to a point where they've used them in a kind of big way. And albeit that intelligence is never a slam dunk, to coin a phrase, it's pretty clear that this is a regime that doesn't think anything of using chemical weapons against its own people.
What are the triggers, though, for at least UN action? And, if we're to look at the 2003 situation, obviously a bunch of charts and fuzzy pictures of trucks is not an appropriate trigger. We have a lot more in the way of forensics here in Syria, but still, what's left to learn?
Well, I think the most important thing about the UN is to get consensus within the Security Council. And right now we have Russia and maybe China quite prepared to use their veto power. So there's a real concern about taking this to the UN and having the proposal, or the resolution in this case, actually rejected by the UN. So it has always been an issue in the U.S., in U.S. foreign policy, that we don't want to have our foreign policy initiatives somehow vetoed or somehow dependent on what the Russians think. And I think we've kind of come to a point here where we cannot allow that. So it becomes really a more cosmic issue about the relationship of the United States as a kind of a world leader to deal with the UN.
Wouldn't you say, though, Ambassador Hill, former U.S. ambassador to Iraq, that what we're seeing here, in a sense, is the Tenet Rumsfeld legacy, which since 2003 invites anyone to basically say, huh, what? Weapons of mass destruction? Give me a break. The Russians are doing it.
I think the standard of proof is high, and it should be high. And I would agree with the proposition that the Tenet Rumsfeld, if you will, experience makes that standard of proof very high. So the real question will be, can the administration make its case? They clearly made their case to the British and the French. Certainly the British and French were very interested in doing something and doing something quickly. But what we've seen in the last couple of days is the British in particular really want to slow this train down.
And the opposition, again, using almost the exact same argument as the Russians here. So, you know, it's not simply the Russians who are, you know, engaged in this sense of fatigue about American saber rattling in the Middle East. As time goes on, does the U.S. lose its military options on some level, that there's really no way to do anything that's going to have any sort of substantive value?
Well, I mean, there are two fundamental issues. One is the so-called legal authorities, and that's what this whole battle on the UN is about. The second is the issue of when a country uses banned weapons, either against combatants or, in this case, against civilians, what are we going to do about it? And I think if we are sure about the evidence, and of course that's one of the issues that has been heavily discussed in recent hours, if we're really concerned about the evidence, we're not going to worry about the legal mandate. We are going to proceed and punish a regime that has used these banned weapons.
Ambassador Christopher Hill, former U.S. ambassador to Iraq, assistant secretary of state and an envoy to negotiations over Kosovo and North Korea. He's currently dean of the Korbel School of International Studies at the University of Denver. Ambassador, thanks so much.
Thank you.
But the really big story in the Syrian crisis may be how Iran will react. Syria's ally for strategic and religious sectarian reasons has said that an attack on Syria will lead to Iran launching a retaliatory attack on Israel, fanned by, quote, the flames of outrage, a metaphor from the new leadership in Iran. Afshan Astavar joins us. He's a research scientist with CNA, formerly the Center for Naval Analysis, a federally funded center for research on policy. Welcome.
Thank you.
So you're an Iranian expert at CNA. How seriously are we to take the metaphors, colorful metaphors from the new leadership in Tehran?
Well, I'd take them at metaphors, you know, at the moment. They're rhetorical devices. Iran is certainly concerned about any U.S. activity in Syria. They're proclaiming that concern in sort of the guise as veiled threats. But I wouldn't take any Iranian action as an absolute certainty. Certainly not.
Well, let's look at the situation. Since we talked about 2003 with Ambassador Hill, one of the implications of the invasion of Iraq was that it really strengthened Iran's position in the region. It seems to me Iran's role in the Syrian crisis runs the risk of further strengthening Iran's role in the region by being able to credibly threaten Israel. What do you think about that?
Well, if Iran were to do anything against Israel, it would seriously complicate Iran's own strategy, which is, for the most part, to deter attacks from Israel or for the United States. What it's doing in Syria now is trying to not lose Syria as a strategic ally and as a sort of a strategic middleman between Iran and Hezbollah. If it loses Syria, it's going to be damaging to Iran's overall regional strategy and also their strategy against the United States. So right now they're trying to hold on to what they have. If they start attacks against Israel or somehow target U.S. personnel, let's say in the Persian Gulf, it would just open up a new front for them, and it's something that they just can't survive.
I wonder how much control they have over the situation with this flames of outrage kind of rhetoric. There are plenty of jihadists inside Syria right now who probably, it's not insane of me to suggest, would be happy to run over to the Golan and start fighting over there as well. If Iran encourages that sort of thing, the war could be widened even if Iran doesn't want it. What do you make of that?
Well, it's true. I mean, there's many moving pieces that Iran has absolutely no control over. Iran has some influence over Hezbollah and a couple Palestinian factions that it works with. But for the most part, it's fighting the jihadists right now. So for the jihadists to open up a third front, that could certainly happen. They wouldn't do it for Iran's benefit, however. They would do it to further complicate the case. But right now, for the jihadists to do that would be sort of a strategic blunder in that they've been concentrating on overthrowing Assad. And if the U.S. goes essentially on the same side with the jihadists, they would have little reason to sort of spoil that benefit.
We're talking with Afshan Astavar, an Iran analyst with CNA, formerly the Center for Naval Analysis. Let's talk about, you know, what I find curious, and that is, why doesn't the U.S. and the international community have more leverage on Iran in this situation to compel them to actually produce a settlement here? It seems that leverage over Iran has been curiously absent throughout this entire conflict.
Yeah, we don't have any, particularly in this case. Syria is Iran's best friend in the region, and really their only close ally. And Iran doesn't want to lose that. And Iran is not going to agree to any settlement where that relationship is lost, especially when they feel like they have some leg to stand on. The international community, you know, Russia and to a lesser extent China, more or less agree with Iran and with the Assad regime's view that Assad is fighting al-Qaeda and other terrorists. So Iran doesn't feel like it's alone in this situation. And I think that larger international buffer gives Iran some space to operate outside of any U.S. pressure.
Afshan Astavar is an Iran analyst with CNA, formerly the Center for Naval Analysis. It's a federally funded center for research policy. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
So we've been asking you, should the U.S. get militarily involved in Syria with all the turmoil in the Middle East? Is it still in our national interest to stay involved in this region?
Hello, this is Doug from Salt Lake City. I'm reluctant to get our country further involved in Syria. It seems like we spend a lot of money there to help out people that generally don't like us, and we don't seem to accomplish very much.
My name is Jeff Strum from Orlando, Florida. We don't need to get involved with the civil war over there. That's their war. Why can't the UN police the world instead of the United States?
From Orleans, Massachusetts, you think we should be involved in the region but not in Syria. You write, Obama is kowtowing to Saudi pressure. Unfortunately, I'm very disappointed. Thanks to all of you listeners. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Be part of the conversation. Coming up, who has the right to the image of your face, your beautiful face, right here on The Takeaway. Your face. You love it, you hate it, it's yours. And in the mirror every day, you can see your flaws, your extraordinary advantages there around the eyes, that fine chin.
Smiling faces, sometimes they don't tell the truth.
What you don't see when you look in the mirror every day is a list of your traffic violations, how many unpaid bills you have, the people you've recently emailed, your medical records, and that fuzzy surveillance video of just how crazy you got at the basketball game on your birthday some years back. I'd love to forget about that one, huh? But that's exactly what law enforcement is starting to be able to see with just a few keystrokes, a few massive databases, and software that can recognize faces as well as a mom can pick her own child out of a lineup. The state of Ohio does it on a limited basis, according to a newspaper investigation. And Ohio's Attorney General Mike DeWine told us yesterday, it's not just a Buckeye thing.
As your listeners across the country listen to this, the odds are their state does exactly what we are doing.
26 other states use facial recognition technology in law enforcement. It's a technology that is emerging as a powerful new real-time tool for investigators. What's the law say here, though? Is it possible that walking by an ATM camera could become an illegal search by the government? Well, whenever we get nervous about the law, we often turn to Jeffrey Rosen, president of the National Constitution Center and professor at George Washington University Law School. Professor Rosen, welcome.
Great to be here.
So how worried should I be about the legal implications of my face dragging with me all of my personal data all the time, essentially wherever there's a computer?
Well, I think you should be pretty worried. On the one hand, what Ohio's doing right now may not violate the law. If all they're doing is taking mugshots, plugging it into a database of 20 million people, and figuring out the 12 most likely suspects, you might say that's no different than taking DNA samples that have been abandoned and putting them in public databases and figuring someone out. But what's scary about this is it raises the possibility of ubiquitous surveillance 24/7 in public. So using this technology, the police could take a picture of anyone in front of a protest scene using a cell phone, plug the image into a database, match that with the license plate recognition technology that allows us to track every location of a car in a city 24/7, and basically follow someone's movements 24/7 for a month without a warrant.
All right, I want to sort of sketch out the possibility of a challenge here if, in fact, lawyers are going to turn this gray area into something a little more clear. It's recognized, I believe, in common law that a spouse, say, has a special expertise regarding his or her mate, you know, in terms of who they are, their character, that sort of thing, right?
That's right.
Okay, so your wife could identify you, you know, maybe more easily than any other person on the planet, right?
I certainly hope so, especially on a good day.
Exactly. All right. So if a computer technology is developed that can actually duplicate the level of clarity about who you are, where you are, oh, that's my husband, da-da-da-da-da, is there any way in which the government having that technology can be challenged because it interferes with this sense that the people who are closest to us have a sense of understanding of who we are that's private?
Yes, there is a way that it could be challenged, because there's a big difference between my wife and the faceless government that's picking me out of a crowd without individualized suspicion. The objection here is not the accuracy of the technology, although it is far from 100% accurate even now. The question is whether the government should need to have reason to suspect someone before identifying them. And even more so, even if they do have reason to suspect someone, should they be able to follow all of our movements? It's the quantity of information, not the identification itself, that's identified. This is exactly what came up in the DNA case, where a majority of the court upheld the DNA tracking of arrestees. And Justice Scalia said the question isn't whether it's accurate. It might well be accurate. The fact is that the framers of the Constitution generally required warrants before you were allowed to search someone's very private information.
All right, next thought experiment. We've all seen the scene in the movie where the private investigator calls up his pal on the police force and says, run this license plate for me, right?
Yes.
Okay, so the possibility that this data would be out there and available to all kinds of people in a relatively unmanageable way, that's a fear. Mike DeWine, the Attorney General of Ohio, said, oh, we have laws against that. If you get caught doing that, it's a felony in the state of Ohio. Is that enough of a protection for keeping this data from basically seeping into every aspect of our lives?
No, it's not. Our driver protection laws are so sectoral. So the DMV will break the law if they release my address to marketers, but they won't break the law if they use my face to follow all of my movements in public, which is not an adequate protection for privacy. There's also a big difference between the way the public and private sector treats this. If a friend or an enemy of mine were to go out and see me in front of a bar, or let's say they didn't know who I was, just go outside of a bar, snap a picture of me, plug my picture into Facebook, and using facial recognition technology, identify me, and post that on her blog, that would be okay in America. But that would not be okay in Europe, where it would violate data privacy laws that say people have a right to their image.
So there's a gray area in terms of the government being involved. There's a gray area in terms of private use of this data. I'm wondering if this technology, the way that it's developing, and facial recognition being kind of sort of the lead here, that we're eventually going to get to the point where the whole concept of a warrant is moot, that it just won't exist anymore.
I think this is the central legal question, and it leads to the broader question, do we have any expectation of anonymity in public? And I think the framers of the Constitution had a clear answer to that question. As Justice Scalia said in his great dissent, anonymity in public was the center of what the Fourth Amendment meant to protect. They wanted to protect dissidents who criticized King George from being identified without warrants. Although identification of individual suspects may be okay, what makes this a gray area is once that leads to the tracking and ubiquitous surveillance of suspects without a warrant, that violates the right to anonymity that I think the framers would have insisted on.
Well, I won't ask you whether this is going to be a boom for plastic surgeons altering people's faces. Jeffrey Rosen, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Jeffrey Rosen is president and CEO of the National Constitution Center and professor at George Washington University Law School.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with The New York Times and WGBH Boston Public Radio. The Takeaway is supported by the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia and the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.
Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Forget the United Nations. An agency with some real clout is the International Boundary and Water Commission.
We basically set aside water in the United States reservoirs that will be released and delivered to Mexico. We do not believe that the Mexican system is managed in a similar fashion.
That's Sally Spiner from the IBWC, which oversees a 70-year-old water treaty between the U.S. and Mexico. Along the border, it's been hot and dry. And as you can hear, there's some tension brewing over the water. The farmers really feel it.
We've had a water shortage for the last 2 years.
That's Homero Chavez in the northern Mexican state of Chihuahua.
If you don't have enough water, it will reflect on your prices drastically sometimes, you know. And your profits will go down, of course.
Farmers on both sides of the U.S.-Mexican border are suffering, but the drought could be complicated by the accusation that Mexico is not living up to its part in the U.S.-Mexican Water Treaty. With us now is Monica Ortiz Uribe, senior field correspondent for Fronteras. Monica, welcome.
Hi, thanks for having me on.
How bitter is this dispute, and is the U.S. making a formal accusation?
Well, yes, as you can imagine, if you're a farmer in South Texas and you're having to pool together your water rights, you're having to set some of your fields fallow and not plant, and having to spend a bunch of extra money to get infrastructure to get water, I mean, you're going to be pretty upset if you don't have enough water and you depend on partially Mexico's deliveries to get you your water. Yes, there's going to be quite a bit of bitterness.
Well, let's listen to Jesus Luevano, who says Mexico is basically doing its best here.
Because usually with the rains in the past, we were able to comply with Mexico obligations under the treaty.
But not this time around. What's Jesus's argument, and is anyone buying it?
Correct. Well, that is the main problem. Mexico has in the past relied on wet weather to meet its treaty obligations, which means like a tropical storm, a hurricane, excess rain. It's all that water that overflows from their reservoirs, their dams in northern Mexico, and it flows downstream to the Texas border and down the Rio Grande. And so when you're in a drought, there's not that excess rain, so they fell behind on their water delivery. And that's why the farmers in Texas are having a hard time. And I should add that not only the farmers on the Texas side of the border depend on these Rio Grande deliveries, right on the other side in the Mexican states of Coahuila and Tamaulipas, they also benefit from those Rio Grande deliveries. And so they're also in bad shape.
So there's a real sense of desperation on the Mexican side, but there's a lot of anger among farmers in Texas. What have you found there?
Correct. Well, the issue is that the United States, when it plans out its irrigation cycles, it sets aside a percentage of its reservoir to deliver to Mexico. So what they're trying to do, what the American side is trying to do, is get the Mexican irrigation districts to set aside water at the beginning of the cycle so they can rely on a certain amount of deliveries every year. And so that's what they're working on now, and it looks like they're finalizing plans to accomplish that. If they do, that will be better news for the folks in South Texas and on the other side of the border there as well.
Right now, it's about neighborliness.
They're not good neighbors. I mean, my neighbor right there, if they have a problem, I run over there and I help them.
Joe Pennington, what did he say to you?
Right. Well, he's a farmer outside Raymondville in South Texas, and he's one of the ones that's hurting. One of the interesting things he told me was that he usually plants between 3,000 to 4,000 acres of cotton. This year, because of the water shortage, he only planted 60 acres, and he planted it as a dry land crop, which means he didn't irrigate it. And he says, you know, the seed didn't even come off the ground. So that's how desperate they are.
That's how dry they are on both sides of the border, and it's a dispute between the U.S. and Mexico over water. Mónica Ortiz Uribe, senior field correspondent for Fronteras. Thanks so much.
You're welcome.
So a breakthrough at Gitmo. It's the first transfer of prisoners in nearly a year. The Pentagon has announced the two Algerians being held at the Guantanamo Bay prison camp are going to be transferred out. The two prisoners were among the first brought to Guantanamo Bay back in 2002, recommended for release back in 2007. Nothing much happens at Gitmo that our pal Carol Rosenberg isn't aware of. She's a reporter for the Miami Herald. Carol, welcome.
Hi, John.
So one of these folks, Nabil Hajarab, was talked about in an op-ed column by John Grisham. They didn't transfer him to Grisham's house, did they?
No, just about this time yesterday, they probably left Guantanamo. They're back in Algeria. John Grisham weighed in a little while ago on the op-ed pages of the New York Times after he'd heard, apparently incorrectly, that one of his books was banned at Guantanamo. He heard that some of detainees had requested some of his books and they had not managed to reach the prisoner. So he decided to look into a given case, and he came up with Nabil Hajarab. And he gave him a spotlight on the op-ed pages of the Times and sort of drew attention to his hunger strike and the fact that Hajarab apparently was a John Grisham fan.
So in the past, the kind of gridlock that surrounds Guantanamo relates to the fact that individuals that the U.S. might want to transfer out have no return address because nations won't take them. There's the question of assurances that they won't, leave wherever they've been transferred to and end up in Yemen to join al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula. Any assurances here on the part of these two individuals?
Well, the State Department says that they have obtained these assurances. You know, about earlier this summer, they put in a new special envoy, Cliff Sloan, and he's been negotiating these transfer deals. The Algerians put out a statement in French earlier today that they had agreed to accept these men in the context of these assurances that had been ongoing negotiations since 2007. You know, the U.S. doesn't want these people becoming world travelers. They want assurances that at least they're not going to get passports. And there is a concern that, you know, after more than 10 years at Guantanamo, they could be pretty angry at us. So the negotiations for transfer involve a promise, a pledge by the Algerians to, first of all, investigate them, and to, second of all, keep an eye on them. You know, a number of Algerians have gone back through the years through these negotiations. And as best as I can tell, none of them have become those problems that we've heard about, the so-called recidivists that the CIA tracks as people who, say, ran away from home and tried to join a movement to get even for either old gripes, old issues that predated their Guantanamo time, or for their detention years at Guantanamo. Algeria seems to have done a good job of resettling these people.
Well, in these cases, Nabil Hajarab is in his 30s, as well as Motai Sayab, also in his 30s. They were in their 20s when they arrived at Guantanamo Bay. What can they possibly tell Algerian interrogators other than, you know, the tides at Guantanamo or the weather report down there? What can they know at this point?
I don't think the Algerian interrogators are interested that much in what goes on at Guantanamo. What they're looking at, as I understand it, is how they came to leave their homeland back in the 90s, before September 11th, and ended up in Afghanistan or Pakistan, actually, where one of them was captured. And they could potentially be prosecuted for association with terror organizations or for something like leaving the country illegally, maybe evading Algerian military service. I don't think the investigation is aimed at learning a lot about Guantanamo. My understanding is the Algerians have been in and out of Guantanamo through the years helping out. So the real question is they're looking at their ideology and trying to figure out who these men are that come back to them many years later after all those years at Guantanamo. They were among the first to get there. They were held at Camp X-Ray. If you close your eyes and think about men on their knees in cages in orange jumpsuits, the earliest days, those were among the, these two men were among those men who got there during that very, very makeshift era.
Well, the two men transferred out of Gitmo, the first transfer in nearly a year, a matter now for the Algerians. Thanks to Carol Rosenberg, reporter for the Miami Herald. Thanks, Carol.
Thank you, John.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with The New York Times and WGBH Boston Public Radio.
From the intensity of grief at Fort Hood, Texas, back in 2009.
Our hearts and prayers go out to those families who have borne the loss of this terrible tragedy. No words can ever fully address your grief and sadness. The Fort Hood community shares your sorrow as we move forward together in the spirit of resiliency.
From that intensity to the clarity of a verdict last week.
The panel of officers seated for the trial of the United States versus Major Nadal Hassan returned a verdict with a unanimous finding of guilty to the first charge of 13 counts of premeditated murder and guilty of 32 counts of the additional charges of attempted premeditated murder.
From that clarity to the certainty of just a little more than 2 hours of jury deliberations needed yesterday to sentence Nadal Hassan to death for those crimes at Fort Hood almost 6 years ago. This is perhaps, though, where the clarity ends. During the Hassan trial, commentators, officers, and military lawyers frequently noted that if there was a case for the death penalty, this was it. What will happen now? Jeffrey Korn is a former Army prosecutor and defense lawyer and a professor at the South Texas College of Law. Jeffrey Korn, welcome.
How are you?
So let's talk for a second about the precedent for the death penalty in the military. The last execution was 1961. What's transpired since then?
Well, for a period of time, the death penalty was halted because of the Supreme Court decision that it violated the Eighth Amendment. But when the Supreme Court reversed that position, the military resurrected the death penalty process and began trying soldiers and other service members for capital offenses. And there have been a number of cases that have led to a death penalty. But the military appellate courts have been extremely cautious in reviewing those trials and have reversed a number of those death penalties. So at this point, we have five service members on death row before Major Hassan. He is the first officer to be sentenced to death in probably more than a century, and I believe the first physician ever sentenced to death by the military.
So is there a single military death row, and would it be at Fort Leavenworth?
Yes, the maximum security military prison is called the Disciplinary Barracks, and that's at Fort Leavenworth, Kansas. And they have a death row, and they have a death chamber there. The method of execution is lethal injection. The military police personnel who are responsible for conducting that mission practice it, train on it, and they're prepared to do it whenever the president decides that one of these cases is ready for execution.
Now, I have no particular enthusiasm for either the death penalty or the execution of any defendant, but in this particular case, given just the outrageousness of it and the sort of recklessness of the murder that was committed at Fort Hood, does Hassan's case put him at the front of the line in some sense legally? How is this going to work?
Well, the incredible depravity of the case doesn't necessarily put him at the front of the line. What could speed him up is the nature of the appeal. And a lot will depend on the issues that are presented by the lawyers who represent him, whoever they may be. The Army will detail lawyers to represent him. And unlike the trial, he doesn't have a right of self-representation on appeal. I suspect he'll have civilian lawyers assisting him, including Mr. Galligan, the retired Army colonel and former military judge who was helping him from the beginning of this incident. It's going to take a good bit of time. I would say, though, I don't have enthusiasm for the death penalty either, to be honest with you. But having sat in that courtroom and watched him and having seen his indifference to the human suffering that he inflicted was stunning. And as a former soldier, I fortunately never had to shoot at anybody, but I certainly had to consider it on a number of occasions. And I always felt that if I had to do it, I would do it because I knew it was my duty and it was the right thing to do, but I would regret it immensely. And you would think that someone like Major Hassan would react that way, that he believed what he did was necessary, but he regrets the human suffering he was compelled to inflict. There was no remorse whatsoever from this defendant. And I think if the death penalty is an authorized penalty and it's not adjudged in a case like this for a defendant like this, then we really have no reason to have it.
Emotional reaction to the Hassan sentence and verdict from Jeffrey Korn, a former Army prosecutor and defense lawyer and a professor at South Texas College of Law. Remind us of what are the differences between the actual carrying out of the execution in the military system versus the civilian system? Is the president involved here?
Well, that is a very significant difference. The Uniform Code of Military Justice, the military's criminal code enacted by Congress, includes a provision that says no sentence of death may be carried out until it is approved by the President of the United States. There's only been one sentence that's been approved by the President since the execution of Gary Gilmore in 1961, and that was President George W. Bush towards the end of his term. He did approve a sentence to death, but then there was a writ of habeas corpus to a federal court, and the sentence was stayed, and President Obama has not approved any. And that's going to take a long time because there'll be numerous appeals before it ever gets to that point. But if it does, I think Major Hassan's case is going to be the military analog of Timothy McVeigh. I think whoever is in office in the White House when that case is ready for approval will have a very difficult time not approving the sentence and ordering the execution.
Jeffrey Korn, former Army prosecutor and defense lawyer, professor at the South Texas College of Law on the Nidal Hassan death penalty verdict and sentence. Prosecutor Jeffrey Korn, thanks so much.
Thank you.
So we'd love to know from you if it's worth it for the United States to remain invested in the Middle East. One of you in Fairbanks, Alaska, no, because we have our own problems in our own homeland to get done. I don't want to hear a future speech that entails a few more major cities are bankrupt, but the rest of the world is doing great with American money. And here from Eugene, Oregon, only minimally, I think we have several reasons to be interested in the security of the region. However, I also would like to see military dollars spent differently. Although it may have no budgetary correlation realistically, as a kindergarten teacher, I hope for a time when more of the budget would be spent on education reform. Love to know what you think. 877-8-MY-TAKE. Stay with us.
Support for The Takeaway comes from Lumosity. Lumosity.com's daily workouts are designed to improve memory and attention, dedicated to helping people feel sharper, think faster, and remember more. It's all at Lumosity.com.
A record of success.
We follow leads wherever they take us. We're not intimidated as to where that lead takes us, and we're doing that to protect the people of New York City. We've had 16 plots against New York since September 11th. None of them have succeeded. It's been a combination of good work on a part of the federal government, good work on a part of the NYPD.
New York Police Commissioner Ray Kelly on MSNBC defending the NYPD. No attacks, 16 plots, none of them successful. We are all aware that no attack has succeeded in New York in more than a decade. We'll have to take his word on the 16 plots. But does that record alone justify the manner in which the NYPD now operates since the 9/11 attacks as a global anti-terrorism force with a close watch on citizens, both foreign and domestic. It's one of the questions being asked in Muslim communities around New York City following an Associated Press report that a judge has granted a request by the NYPD to designate individual mosques as terrorism enterprises.
We have an agreement, a handshoe agreement, that has been authorized by a federal judge. We follow that stipulation, and it authorizes us to do a whole series of things. Certainly, investigations are part of it.
Among the whole series of things Kelly suggests are authorized under these terrorism enterprise investigations, TEIs, are the planting of informants among mosque worshippers and inside mosque-affiliated community organizations, recording sermons, documenting style and intensity of worship among individual Muslims to try and match that with terror-suspected Islamist organizations. What's perhaps most surprising about all this is that the authorization apparently allows for an investigation to proceed without evidence of specific criminal wrongdoing. Let's get some reaction. Linda Sarsour is the executive director of the Arab American Association of New York. Linda, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
So no specific criminal wrongdoing, but you can be viewed as a terrorism enterprise. What's your reaction? What's your understanding of what's going on here?
My understanding is that my organization, the Arab American Association of New York, had a goal for by the New York Police Department to infiltrate my board. So not only were they sending confidential informants to act as clients and potentially come to our event and listen in to the discussions we were having, but they wanted to actually have someone official on our board. And what that tells me is that I'm a social service agency. I'm filling a need. I'm serving immigrants. I provide after-school programming, English classes to immigrant women. What is the lead, Commissioner Kelly? Commissioner Kelly and his deputies have lied to us numerous times over the years. And we have to understand that we're taking Kelly's word for it. We have no independent oversight of the New York Police Department. There has never been an investigation by any level of government, city, state, or federal government. So we're basing this all on Commissioner Kelly saying, I got this, I'm following the handshoe guidelines. And as a matter of fact, on October 1st, the handshoe lawyers are going back to court with the New York Police Department for open arguments.
What does handshoe refer to?
Handshoe refers to a case back in the 1970s about the infiltration of political groups here in New York City, and it's named after Barbara Handshoe. And the handshoe guidelines basically provide some guidelines that the NYPD has to adhere to in order to infiltrate or to surveil a particular institution. And we believe that the New York Police Department does not have the leads they are saying they have to go into our community organizations and mosques.
Well, let's just say that they do for a moment. Then the question to you has to be, are you a terrorism enterprise?
That's the question that we need to ask Commissioner Kelly. He has been spying on the Islamic Society of Bay Ridge since 2003.
What you're saying there sounds like you're not answering the question. You deny that, right?
Absolutely, I deny that. I mean, I'm getting city, state contracts. I am an American. I am a New Yorker. And if the New York Police Department if we are terrorism enterprises, why are we allowed to continue to operate? Why are we allowed to continue to do the work? Why hasn't there been any arrests made?
Okay, let's broaden this a little bit. What role does a mosque play in the community in the sense that it becomes a kind of central intersection in Muslim communities around the United States?
The mosque is a sanctuary. It's a place where we get closer to God. It's a place that we interact with our community members. And according to the New York Police Department, the more religious you are, the more potential that you can be radicalized. And that's the problem here. It's the idea that the more Muslim you are, the more you are on this path to terrorism or what they call jihadization. And if you read the report from the New York Police Department, Radicalization in the West, it says if you stop smoking, if you stop wearing hip-hop clothing, if you grow a beard, if you have particular occupations, if you start frequenting mosques more often, then you're going on this path of radicalization. And that's outrageous.
Although within Muslim communities, there have been discussions within the community of individuals who come into a community, behave in a way that seems to be jihadist, and that offends individuals within that mosque. You're familiar with stories like that.
Absolutely.
If people within the mosque are concerned about that behavior, why shouldn't law enforcement be concerned about that behavior?
because law enforcement should see the American Muslim community as partners. If you trust us as partners to root out potential terrorists in our community, that's what's community policing. That's effective law enforcement. When our community knows it's being spied on, when we know there are confidential informants amongst us, we don't even trust the worshipers that we're praying with at the mosque. So the question here is it important for law enforcement to have effective relations with the Muslim community? If I already think there's informants in my mosque, and people have told me this, if there are already informants amongst us, so why doesn't the NYPD root out the terrorists? Why do they want us? They don't trust us that we are here as partners in the fight for counterterrorism.
So it's less offensive to you, that is to say not offensive to you, to have a relationship with the NYPD that you would notify them of such an individual. Yet if there's an informant in place, that shuts everybody down.
It creates mistrust between us and law enforcement. Law enforcement, NYPD has put the entire Muslim community as suspect. So if we are the suspects, how are the suspects going to go to law enforcement to tell them that there are things going on in our communities? We continue to encourage our community to go with any information, whether it's around drugs, violence, domestic violence, terrorism. This is what we want to do. The NYPD is the one that's creating this hostile environment that's really hindering our efforts to create better relationships with NYPD.
And if New Yorkers say, well, you know, Commissioner Kelly says there have been 16 plots, no attacks, whatever you're doing, it's good.
There's a report by ProPublica that NYPD has had little or nothing to do with any of those foiled plots. And I want to encourage people to read this new book coming out by the AP reporters that broke the story called Enemies Within. New documents that have never been revealed before. Read the book in depth. Tell me if you think that the Muslim American community are not Americans or that we don't have the same right to privacy as every other American in the United States.
Thoughts 50 years after the March on Washington? A little parallel here.
Yes. For myself personally, I'm joining the ranks of Martin Luther King, Malcolm X, and others who also were infiltrated by law enforcement, civil rights activists who had their movements tried to be broken by law enforcement agencies. I don't think Martin Luther King would be proud to hear that the American Muslim community is under this type of targeting by law enforcement, and think he would be standing with us right now, 50 years later, saying that we should all be treated fairly and equally in the United States.
Wearing the surveillance with the pride, in some sense, in American history. Linda Sarsour is the executive director of the Arab American Association of New York. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
We reached out to Police Commissioner Ray Kelly, invited him on the program to tomorrow to respond. We'll let you know if we speak to him. We'll certainly have him on the program. We're asking you all this hour, with the Middle East in such intense turmoil, do you think it is still in the interest of the U.S. to stay involved in the region?
Ethan Denault from Tampa, Florida. Every adventure that the West has had in the Middle East has come back to bite them. Although my pragmatism says that we must remain involved in the Middle East, my emotions tell me that it's probably best if we let them shoot it out to get it all out of their system before we re-engage.
One of you in North Texas listening to us on KERA. Yes, this is America. We want their oil and a war to stimulate the economy, preferably without our soldiers on the ground. What do you think? Tell us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.